are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 12th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Adam Kokesh, a libertarian candidate for president in 2020, also formerly host of Adam versus the Man, will be joining us for a debate about libertarianism and not libertarianism. Also on the program, Trump threatens a shutdown and cannot find a chief of staff. Nancy Pelosi close to securing her speakership, and in a win for progressives, drops the supermajority for tax rule. Paygo may be next to go. And Ivanka's gains may be illegal, but the Opportunity Zone's tax benefits should be criminal regardless. Senate confirms another right-wing, unqualified judge for life, this time on a 50-50 tie broken by Mike Pence. Meanwhile, speaking of judges, Trump heads to the Supreme Court seeking the ability to promote an asylum ban at the southern border. And Harris will remain on the judiciary, but he chucked up again. Joe Manchin, now the leader in the statutory fight against climate change on behalf of Democrats.
Tell you what, Jenks.
Meanwhile, Michael Cohen sentenced. Not quite sure what he got.
I think it's 36 months.
36 months?
Yep.
That's still waiting on that. And Theresa May may, or I should say, will face a vote of no confidence this evening in the complete mess that is Brexit or Nebrexit or Brexit. Dems save SNAP and Republicans block the War Powers Act in the Farm Bill. And Amazon employees at Staten Island seek to unionize and are using the $3 billion giveaway from New York City as leverage. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we're taking the opportunity at the end of the year to have a debate. We haven't had one of these libertarian debates, or really any debates, in a long time, I have to say. I mean, obviously, if you are a member of the show and you listen to the second half live or not, you'll hear occasionally we'll have little debates with people who call in on the phone. But this is the first one that we've set up on purpose, I mean, with advance notice in a long time. Basically, this came about because, as you know, I thought I was going to debate Steven Crowder at
Politicon.
Politicon. And then he just ghosted, which I think I was just reading as a millennial thing. Where you just, you got plans to debate somebody, and then you just stop returning the emails of Politicon. I guess that's how ghosted
debating content.
I'm a pretty flaky guy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's my understanding is how it works.
It's app. Yeah, you set up a debate.
I just looked it up in the Urban Dictionary. And anyways, so Steven Crowder ghosted, and I ended up debating Charlie Kirk. That was fun. Anyways. But I really wanted to debate Steven Crowder. And, I made an email hoping that he would respond, and he didn't. And then he took a break because he's dealing with some personal illness issues, certainly understand how relentless this job can be. And my hope is that when he comes back, he'll agree to debate me because he seems so earnest about his desire to have people change his mind and to debate the issues. And he keeps saying he has leftist aunts. Anyways, in the middle of this back and forth on Twitter, I guess Adam Kokesh had some questioning or run-in with Crowder. I'm not 100% sure. But someone had told him that I have a standing a challenge to libertarians. And then he tweeted me and took it up, and we arranged it, and it all happened fairly quick. I mean, I'm open to this stuff, as that guy Brandon Tarkatov.
Brandon Straka?
Brandon Straka. I'm sorry. People know I'm bad with names. I'm bad with names.
Who's that guy?
He really should be nicer to me, considering I'm the only person who remembers his name.
The walk away guy. There was a walk away movement, and I said I would go on his show. I'm very open to these type of things. So
I'm impressed you could even find a libertarian to debate these days. Aren't they all Nazis now?
Well, no, that's the thing. I think Adam is very sincere about this stuff. I've seen some other people who are less sincere, but that's for another day. Let me just remind you. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And B, if you're interested in coming to the live show, we are now down in to where you can say basic 3 dozen tickets are left. So you've got very little time. So go to majority.fm for tickets for the January 13th show. One of today's sponsors is Skillshare. And the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majority are going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. We may need to confirm that there's still room for that. You should just double check with Noah, because we've been doing this for a couple of weeks. You get free 2 months of total access to their entire library. It's a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation. I think the first time I said mediation, it's possible. I haven't checked on that, but meditation and everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You can have no problem finding courses that will be useful to you both in your personal and professional life. I've got, I do not have the kids for the majority of the weekend. I am not with the kids, so I'm going to be catching up on a couple of these. You want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing, or you want to learn how to do something totally new? Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages, Photoshop, you name it. I feel like I could take a Photoshop class right now, and an accounting are the two I think that I should do. Like I say, I did the knife work, and I employed that in cutting onions for latkes.
That's cool. Are you taking suggestions as the ones you should do, or from the staff? Because I'm voting meditation.
Oh, I'm not doing that. All right, you can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majority. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. That's skl.sh/majority. And I put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube, or it'll be in our podcast description. Check it out, skl.sh/majority. All right, let's start with this. Donald Trump. By now, you've probably heard about the. Wait, oh, this isn't the meeting with him with Nancy, is it? This is afterwards. Okay, so they had a meeting with. Do we have any of that Nancy and Chuck meeting? Oh, I thought we had. Oh, you played that yesterday? Oh. We saw some of it, but not all of it. But He's had this line there, too. He meets with Pelosi and Schumer, and it doesn't go well. He keeps trying to say, well, I want border security. And then they say, oh, we're willing to pay for border security. And he goes, well, it has to have a wall in it. And they go, we don't want the wall. And then he's coming up with all the, you could see it's his mind working. Like, I've got to get all access, all those reasons why we need the wall again. And he's like, the caravan and the drugs, and the murderers. And of course the really sick people. And, apparently he really enjoyed that one because, I don't know why he's surrounded by a member, you know, some type of like a bishop in this thing. But
that's not Mike Pence's new outfit.
No, he's in the Oval Office later, and he's really, really stuck on the medical problems.
Border security. You know, Republicans want very strong border security, and honestly, the Democrats, or most of them, it's hard to believe, but most of them want open borders, and that leads to crime and leads to other problems. And, you know, one of the problems that people don't talk about, you have a tremendous medical problem coming into a country. Communicable disease, tremendous problems. People don't want to talk about it. I don't like talking about it, but these are
the
difficulties of what they want to do. So we want strong borders. We want people coming into our country legally through a process. We want people that are going to love and help our country. And I don't think they feel the same way. Or maybe they just don't want us to get a vote. You know, it could be that, too, because it's hard to believe that they don't want some form of protection.
Well, you know, it's so weird. I increasingly I look at this and it's like watching a cosplay, but he thinks everybody's taking it seriously. And I get that. There's a subset of people out there who he feels need this reinforcement and will believe what he's saying. But increasingly, it feels like they're behind you. You got them. And just saying stuff like communicable diseases over and over again, I don't know that it really is gaining. It's starting to feel a little monotonous is the problem, I think.
Well,
he's
losing.
Go read and just come up with a couple of names of diseases at least. Right? Like, as you saw him look down when he's like, communicable diseases. Just take it to the next level. You could just say, like, I don't know, we have tuberculosis coming in or diphtheria or meningitis. I don't know.
It makes you, at least me, want to go on a very, like, typically liberal rant in the sense that, like, the notion of this guy commenting on other people's contributions to this country is just
right.
Awe-inspiring.
We are living in an era where crime, all sorts of crime, are at the lowest in generations. More than likely a function, in my estimation, of getting let out of gasoline. But that's just a theory that has gained some credence. But the idea that somehow we're letting in more crime, there's no data to support that immigrants are any more apt to commit a crime than native-borns, and actually in some respects less. But it's... You know, I understand why he needs to keep saying that, but I just feel like mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, and how about all of the people who have committed crimes and have changed and reformed themselves and are contributing to society? Like, I don't care what metric you use, he's below it. Like, he's just the worst.
Well, the other problem is that we have right now, like, you know, on top of all the crimes, I think that arguably the president has committed and Ivanka has committed. The most recent is that they were actively promulgating a tax cut that they are both taking advantage of to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm not talking about a capital gains. I'm talking about those opportunity zones. That they're gaining money on
synergy
because of their real estate holdings. But that's a separate thing. But so Donald Trump, again, I think is in for some problems. And there seems to be at least a heightened confidence by the Democrats in some respect. And I think, you know, part of that is coming to a large extent from the heightened confidence by the Progressive Caucus. We've had two things happening in the House and the Senate that are worth noting. One being that Nancy Pelosi seems to have come to an agreement with rebels in the in their caucus. Rebels, the insurgency, whatever
it is. The Maoist insurrectionists.
Yeah, except for they, unfortunately, these people tend to be more centrist, you know, sort of more centrist insurrectionists.
So
but
like Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. And but nevertheless, they were able to at least get a commitment for a rules change involving leadership, that leadership cannot serve more than three terms in a row, and that it would be retroactive for the existing set of Democratic leaders in the House. So Clyburn, Hoyer, and Pelosi, this would be their last term if this passes. And the only way that they could stay if there was a two-thirds majority of the Democratic caucus that voted for them as opposed to 50-50. And, you know, based upon what we saw with Jeffries and Lee, you know, 50-50 is typical. So that's a good sign. Not sure if that's going to apply to committees. Not even sure if that's going to apply as a permanent rule because the caucus has to vote on it. But Pelosi said she would abide by it anyways. So she's stepping down. This is her last go. And hopefully there'll be nurturing of other leadership in the House. Simultaneously, Democrats basically saved SNAP benefits, food stamps, as we used to call it, for probably, it's hard to measure what the Republicans would have cut, but it's safe to say millions. And we don't know if it's 10 million, we don't know if it's 5 million or 2 million, because it's counterfactual, but they
massive
clearly say
suffering averted.
Millions and millions of people will be getting food stamps. Unfortunately, in that same bill, the farm bill, Republicans have put in a provision that will unprivilege, and it's unclear if this is going to get stripped out or not, but it seems like Paul Ryan, the great Paul Ryan, who's going out just like he came in, slimy, is going to keep it in, which will unprivilege the War Powers Act. Ro Khanna has a resolution under the War Powers Act to stop what's going on in Yemen that matches essentially the one that Bernie and Mike Lee are promoting in or will get passed in the Senate. The problem is that if it doesn't pass in the House, it's unclear as to whether or not it would pass. It's unlikely that it would pass in the Senate with the new Senate coming in. So the new House would pass it, but the new Senate wouldn't. So it's unclear what the implications are to me. I haven't seen anybody quite map it out, but it's not good. In terms of reigning and what we're doing in Yemen in particular is what it's about. Meanwhile, in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, two pieces of evidence, really three pieces of evidence that Chuck Schumer is just not up to this job. Okay? Put aside his politics for a moment. Harry Reid came into the Senate, was anti-choice. That never, ever implicated his leadership, and it never implicated any of his votes, frankly. So put aside a moment of Chuck Schumer's politics, although I suspect that they inform his incompetence in certain areas, but I'm not sure about that. Chuck Schumer negotiated with the Republicans so that Kamala Harris could stay on the Senate Judiciary Committee. The loss of those seats in the last midterms meant that the Democrats had one less seat on the Judiciary Committee. She really wanted to stay. He negotiated a deal with the Republicans where they added one more member to the committee. So their dominance on that committee is greater, but it's irrelevant because it's always going to be a party vote anyways. She will stay on the committee, so she'll have an opportunity. That's why I think she does the best, frankly, is in asking questions of nominees and whatnot. But that is evidence to Chuck Schumer's either incompetence or willful incompetence or inability to lead. And sometimes when you lead, it's about getting people to do stuff that they don't want to do for the sake of the group that you're leading. That's basically the point of it.
What?
If leadership was, I just hand out goodies, then anybody could do that. If leadership just meant, like, I'm never going to ask anything of you, then, you know, Santa would be a leader as opposed to just a guy who gives presents.
No, Santa, you might get coal. Still, it actually doesn't work.
That's true.
Santa is more of an accountability system.
So here's my point. Why do I think that Chuck Schumer can't get anybody to do anything that they don't want to do in the Senate? Where do I even get the idea that the Senate leader does stuff like that? Why would I think that Harry Reid would sometimes go to a member and say, look, I'm not going to release you for this vote. There's going to be a price to pay for it if you do it. And I know you think you need to vote this way for your reelection, or I know this is part of your brand or whatnot, but we need you on this vote, or we need you to do X or Y, and I want you to do it. And if you don't do it, then you're going to be on the wrong side of me, and that's a bad place to be. That's what a leader does, or at least that's my imaginary notion of what a leader does. If only we had insight as to what a Senate leader does from, let's say, someone who served in the Senate, someone who is not even necessarily aligned with my politics. Someone like, I don't know, like Claire McCaskill, former senator, just got, was just on her way out, I guess. Still a senator.
What about your party, though? Democrats have gone ahead and reelected Schumer here on the Senate side to be majority leader. Nancy Pelosi looks like she will be elected Speaker of the House. This is not exactly a fresh new face of leadership for the party. Are they the right people to challenge Trump?
Oh, I don't. Yeah. I mean, I think Schumer's really good at his job. And I publicly opposed Harry Reid in his reelection at one point, just because I didn't think he was the right guy for the job at that moment. I think Chuck's the right guy for the job at this moment because he is very good at trying to pull people together when it really matters and giving people the space to vote against the party line and not get on him. I mean, he was great with me. I mean, whenever I needed to vote against most of the Democratic caucus because of I had a difference of opinion with him, he never made me feel uncomfortable or that I was somehow betraying him or my fellow Democrats. So it really more is about who is coming up that is inspiring. Who are the young voices and faces that are inspiring?
But also, is it who they are and, you know, is the center of gravity changed in the party? If Republicans have seen their party sort of taken over by Trump, there is this interesting split. You know, people like you are more and more a vanishing breed when it comes from, you know, senators who are from Republican-leaning states. Is it still possible to – is there a center?
Oh, yeah. There will always be a center. It's not heavily populated right now. But when the pendulum swings back, it will be more populated. You know, Kyrsten Sinema won in Arizona as a moderate. Beto lost in Texas as a progressive. Their states are very similar in terms of their makeup. And Kyrsten said, I want to work together. I'm a moderate. She was an unabashed moderate. Beto was not that. And so if you want
I don't even care about her assessment of that. I'm more interested in just the whole point of Chuck Schumer's never asked me to do anything that was uncomfortable. Never. Now, you could say, well, that was smart of Chuck, because if it wasn't for Chuck doing that, Claire McCaskill could have gotten voted out of office. In the face of a massive blue wave, she could have gotten voted out of office.
Right. Isn't Harry Reid really illustrative? Because she's complaining about Harry Reid, who is,
by all accounts,
a conservative Democrat in many respects. Not on key spending issues.
On economics,
he had a populist streak for sure. But clearly was able to recognize people needing to take a vote and was not a rigid ideologue, but still also expected and actually spent capital on killing Social Security cuts. So it's not an ideological objection. It's just any accountability to any constituencies of the Democratic Party
ever objective.
Yeah. Chuck Schumer made it easy for me to and facilitated the idea of a non-cohesive Democratic Party.
That's what it is.
Right? Like,
and that's distinct from rigid
Chuck
ideology.
Chuck Schumer never... This is distinct from ideology. This is partisan.
Right.
Like the most partisan, you know, Democrat in the world whose ideology could be far to the right of mine should take the exact same issue with
exactly.
this. That like there's no party discipline. That we can't do, there's no way to execute a strategy or a tactic or to wage politics if you do not hold those members of your party to account when they don't help the team when they need to.
Absolutely. And that's another reason too, well, there'll never be any kind of like parallel with quote unquote Republican moderates, because I was wrong about Susan Collins in the disgusting vote on Kavanaugh, but it's like, even as a quote unquote moderate, the best way to understand her is just as a Republican team player.
Yeah,
they
of
don't
course.
Tolerate that nonsense
of
on
course.
The other side, period.
Of course.
And people shouldn't hear either. And Schumer doesn't have any strategy, and he barely has tactics.
Well, I mean, his strategy just may be like, how do I stay in power?
Right.
And I will continue to be the minority leader
success, yeah.
Because if I don't ask anything of anybody, I'm the perfect guy.
Doggone it, people like me.
It's like a teacher that just gives out A's.
There's an old book
yeah, exactly.
called There's Nothing right. in the Middle of the Road But Yellow Stripes and Dead Armadillos by Jim Hightower.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, Adam Kokesh for our debate.
America. 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 You are so grand and golden. Oh, I wish I was deep in America tonight. America, America, I watched David Letterman in Australia. Oh, America, you are so grand and golden. I wish I was on.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, and I'm used to saying on the phone. We have a new technology that we are introducing, and I think it should be fine via Skype. This is the first time we've done this, incidentally. Via Skype, I'd like to welcome to the program Adam Kokesh. He is a libertarian candidate for president in 2020. He was formerly the host of Adam versus the Man. And Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Sam.
All right. So what's that? Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Just bear with us. This is a new process for us. So there we go. Right?
Yep.
Better?
Yeah. Awesome.
Okay, great. How do I get me out of there?
You're not in the shot.
Okay, great. All right. Terrific. All right. So Adam, thank you for doing this. And let's just start with, and I've explained to everybody how this debate came about. I saw that you had, questioned, Steven Crowder, and somehow, in the Steven Crowder, my pitch to him to debate me, you got wind of my, libertarian debate challenge. And I remember back in the day watching some of your videos. I think I saw you like at the maybe the Lincoln Memorial
Dancing at the Jefferson Monument.
Oh, the Jefferson Monument. Yeah. And I remember, you know, appreciating it. I'm not a fan of libertarianism, but I appreciate a certain amount of anti-authority impulse. I have a little bit of that myself. All right, but let's just start with this, and we can take this anywhere you want. We haven't really discussed beforehand what we would be talking about, but why don't you just express, because in my experience, there's a lot of different libertarians, types of libertarians out there. Why don't you just express what ilk of libertarian you are and what that means?
Sure. And let me just say thanks again for the opportunity, and thanks to the people on Twitter who brought us together around this. So first, very broadly, libertarian could just mean anyone who believes in freedom. And I generally like that we have that inclusive definition. But to me, freedom is something very specific, and you can define the word freedom. And as I do, freedom is what you have when no one is forcing their will upon you in any way, when you have the ability to exercise your rights without any forceful interference. And I describe myself as a voluntarist, specifically as a type of libertarian, if you will. And that just means that I believe all human relationships, all human interactions should be voluntary, that is, free of force and fraud and coercion. And when you apply that to government, you see what government is today, that it's a coercive monopoly based on a territorial claim, that it claims that it has a sovereign right within a certain geographic area. That's how we think of the government today. And just to be clear, I'm not talking about, you know, a family government or a community government or a corporate government or a organizational government or your club's government. You know, nothing like that. We're talking about the sovereign institution. The government is a coercive monopoly. And that means it's fundamentally illegitimate. It's not based on an ethical premise. And so the question that I see is most important is, how do we move past this as a species right now, you know, this paradigm of violence and coercion, and achieve a voluntary society, one that's harmonious and peaceful and much more productive as a result in terms of meeting real human needs. So what I want to do is create a world in which human problems are addressed with peaceful cooperation rather than a coercive central authority.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, I think that's a pretty comprehensive definition. Let me ask you just a couple of questions so that I'm just clear on some stuff. So we start with this premise of freedom is this notion of you're free from essentially other people's will, as it were, right? And
it's a universal, the ideal of universal nonviolence.
Well, okay. I mean, but what about the notion of, like, you said, this is all a means in which to meet human needs, right? I mean, ideology or philosophy, I'm not sure which you consider it, is it a means to meet those human needs, or is it irrespective of meeting those human needs?
You know, it's a good question. I've never heard it asked exactly in those terms, because you could describe it in both ways. It's a fundamental truth that is how we determine, you know, consistent ethics, you know, what, and to sort of, when we ask the question, what is the right thing to do? Is it ever right to use violence, to use force or the threat of force against someone who's acting peacefully? And then you go, well, gee, those principles lead us to a practical benefit as well. But you could start from the premise of how do we maximize the benefit and then seek the principles?
That's different, because it's quite possible, it seems to me, right? In fact, I think it's my argument that following those libertarian principles that you're talking about as their practice does not meet human needs. Now, I think it's perfectly legitimate to say, Okay, well, sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. But when I am confronted with the idea of either hewing to my what you call a fundamental truth, I would argue it's not, but what you call a fundamental truth, when I am confronted with the idea of hewing to my fundamental truth versus data, let's say, that show it's not meeting human needs, which one wins out for you?
Sure. Well, you might be framing, looking at this from a framing that's just so different from mine. It maybe I can kind of bring that together first, because what I'm suggesting here is that nonviolent cooperative solutions are on the whole better than violent solutions.
I think everybody would agree with that. I mean,
right.
But
so it's so you can,
the question
so you
is
can look at the data. No, I'll get to the question specifically, because you can look at that data and say, well, good things have come out of these violent means. Government has done good things. Government has produced certain goods and services that maybe humanity would not have produced otherwise at the time. I would make the case then that represents a misallocation of resources in terms of meeting real human needs as efficiently as we can. There's that data can't really compare to what is the universal principle. And I think if you really look at the data, you never come to the conclusion, well, sometimes violence is the only way. And we're talking about social organization, not cases of individual defense. I believe in being able to use violence for self-defense. But, you know, we talk about social organization. You never come to the conclusion, well, gee, yeah, I guess if we apply just a little violence like this, it's all going to be better.
Well, now, to be clear, when you say violence, you're just simply saying the state's monopoly of force, right? So just to be clear with people, for instance, I mean, I think I can come up with one very just obvious to me example of where those things do come into conflict, right? Like, let's say, for instance, like health, right? I mean, health, I think we would agree, is a basic human need. Vaccinations. Now, maybe not all vaccines, but let's say polio, right?
Like, sure.
If we don't have everyone vaccinated, and the government is the one that says it's the law, you need to be vaccinated, or you need to be vaccinated before you go to school, you need to be vaccinated. That, just to be clear, by your definition, is a violent act by the government, right? It's saying the law is you got to get vaccinated. That, if I'm not mistaken, is a violation of the non-aggression principle. It is a curtailment on freedom.
Well,
that health is essential. Those two principles that you have, the idea of meeting human needs and freedom, come into conflict there. And I guess my question to you is, when that rubber hits the road, which one wins out for you?
Yeah, no, and if you let me here, it's a great example to examine these different worldviews, the challenge of vaccination. And the libertarian worldview allows for people to have whatever collectives they want voluntarily. It's not necessarily an individualist philosophy. I think it's often misrepresented as that. It could be just as well described through the relationships of human beings being voluntary rather than coercive. So in the case of vaccinations, you don't have a right to decide for someone else what goes in their body, what vaccinations are good for them. You do have a right to decide who you want to associate with and what collectives you want to form. So if you want to come together and form a community where you say, we are going to do these vaccinations, and if you don't have these vaccinations, you're not welcome in our community, or your kids aren't welcome to come to our school, you can do that, but you have to give people the ability to choose for themselves and to opt out. So in the case of if it was the United States federal government, say, saying, if you're not vaccinated, you're not allowed to live in the United States, it's you could look at it two ways. You could say they're forcing the actual vaccination on people, or more accurately, philosophically, they are claiming to own as their property all of the territory that is the United States, and saying, if you live in here, you have to play by our rules that are going to be forced on you, and that's not legitimate.
So if I hear you correctly, then you don't have a problem with the government's monopolization of force as long as they give everybody the option who doesn't want to abide by it to leave the country.
Essentially, yeah, you could say that that would make something voluntary. If the absolute right to individual secession was respected, that would be a big step in making the government an ethically legitimate institution.
But don't people have the right right now to renounce their citizenship in the United States and leave the country?
Oh, you can leave, but you can't claim your property and secede.
Well, so you're saying you want your house and to be not part of America.
Right. But, I mean, if I own it,
do you know,
wouldn't I have?
You know how polio works, right? For instance, I mean, you know how disease works. Like, you could be in your house. I mean, there's a notion of herd immunity. I mean, it's just that's not plausible.
Right. And when there are things like that where humans should come together and should apply these great scientific principles, that's fine. We should just do it with an ethical basis and say we're not going to force
these on.
People
don't. Well, but no, but for herd immunity to work, everybody needs to get vaccinated. That's just the way it works.
You have a right to kick someone out of the herd if you define the herd as a collective of private property. If someone says, I refuse to get vaccinated and I'm going to be a threat to you, you can say, okay, fine. But now you have to stay isolated on your own property and you can't come near any of us. There's no such thing as a public right to come. You don't have a right to expose someone else to polio. Like, just because we don't want the government or any other authority to force vaccinations on someone doesn't mean that we want people to be able to force a disease on someone. That's worse.
So I'm confused now. So if I want to have mandatory polio vaccinations, you can opt out, but the option that you have is to just stay in your house and never come out.
Well, when you say mandatory, what do you mean? Do you mean for your city, for your state, for the entire country?
Let's say the entire country.
Yeah. So if the federal government decides, hey, we're going to force a vaccination on everybody, and California says, hey, you know what? That's it. That's the last straw for us. We're going to secede. Yeah, I think the federal government has to respect that right of that separate collective to assert their autonomy and can't invade the sovereign country of California and force the polio vaccine.
All right. Well, let's not get. I don't want to worry about California. I want to talk about Adam Kokesh. You say that there's a federal vaccination. In this instance, there is no federal vaccination law, but all 50 states require, all right, vaccination.
No, there's a reason. It'd be really hard to impose.
What's that?
It'd be very difficult to impose.
It would be very difficult to impose. But I'm just trying to give an example of like where those two things come in conflict and how they're resolved. Let's move on to the notion of property rights, because my sense is that, I mean, you were talking about, you don't have a problem with corporate governance. You're not talking about corporate governance and.
Right. Well, I use the word corporation there because that's how we think of large company collectives. But in a world where there is no corporatism, where the government gives no special privileges to corporations, you would just have companies.
Right. And, the mail service, like the postal service, right? Like, how does that, is that just doesn't exist in your world? I mean, could it, like the idea of like U.S. Postal, like the U.S. Postal Service, for instance, if we were to, presumably you would abolish it, because it's a government institution. And what would happen then? Is it your presumption that the market would take care of it, or just that like you're shit out of luck if you live out in the rural parts of the country or something?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. We already have FedEx and UPS.
There's a lot of places they won't deliver to, and they certainly won't deliver a letter for 42 cents.
Well, Well, you know, it's funny that you bring that up and you presume that government is the solution. As you say, you want to know about Adam Kokesh. Well, Adam Kokesh lives down 3 miles of dirt road, and USPS does not deliver to where I am, but FedEx usually does. So, I mean, already we have a better voluntary solution than the coercive solution. But bigger picture, I want to point out because...
Well, I mean, wait a second. But it's simply, I mean, that may be the case on your private road. But the reality is that there's a lot of places that FedEx and UPS won't deliver, period. And the U.S. Right. Postal Service goes a lot of places that they won't and will in terms of a letter, a 42-cent letter. Now, yes, you can buy something for, you know, $15, $20 on Amazon or whatever, and they'll deliver it to you. But in terms of a postal service set up to bind the nation and provide communication, it's simply just a fact that the U.S. Postal Service does it better than any private entity ever would because it's not profitable to do it in certain areas. They are statutorily required to provide postal service within a certain distance of everybody in the country.
Well, there's some legitimate points you make in there, but I don't want to bind the country in a sort of isolating communication system. I would want the world to be able to be bound by this communication capability. And if anything, well, the market is already...
The U.S. mail goes to around the world, too.
Right. No, I know. But you say that I would just abolish the Postal Service, and that's not necessarily the case just because it's a government agency. For example, like the VA, you know, I'm a veteran myself. I was in Fallujah in 2004 with the Marines. And my platform as president, if I may back up for a second, if you're going to introduce me as a libertarian presidential candidate, I have to point out that a part of me really dies inside every time I'm introduced as that because you have to be a psychopath of some kind, at least, to want to be president of the United States, to say, I want to have this authority and this power over so many people. I think there has to be something really wrong with you. My platform is based on turning the presidential election into a referendum on whether or not the federal government should be allowed to exist at all. So I'm not going to be putting on the ring of power. I'm throwing it into the fire right away. I resign on day one. My platform is to serve as a bankruptcy agent of the federal government and proceed and be able to proceed through a peaceful, orderly, responsible dissolution that would leave us with 50 independent states. So,
what court?
Some institution of value.
What court's going to oversee the bankruptcy?
What court?
Yeah.
The American people. You don't need a court to oversee a bankruptcy necessarily.
Well, you got to protect. I mean, what do you mean by the bankruptcy? I mean, like you protection from the creditors, sell off the assets. Like what right. Under what auspices?
So the platform for this is going to be laid out in detail long before the election ever happens. So the American people will know exactly what they are voting for. And in that sense, we're disowning the illegitimate debt. Most of the national debt, as I think you would agree, the debt to foreign governments and foreign banks and foreign corporations or American corporations even, is not a legitimate debt. In fact, it's intergenerational child abuse to force your children to pay for stuff that they never had a say in. So we get to go
wait,
in
wait,
and
you're
say
talking about, wait, are we talking about Social Security here?
No, that would be included in some ways. It depends on how you want to see how the investment into Social Security is, you know, how fair you would decide that is. But
you would do all this unilaterally. Is that it? Like,
well,
I mean,
no,
I guess I'm being half facetious because obviously, like, I don't, with all due respect, I don't think you're going to win. But we may not come to this. But I guess my point is that, like, the idea of having no central authority, no authority that we all agree and enter into some type of social contract about, whether it's simply by birth, right? We get certain rights by birth certain advantages.
You would still, if you want a central authority, you could have it at the state level after we dissolve the federal government.
But why is the state level necessarily better than the federal level?
Well, how big? Let me ask you, Sam. For as someone who believes in the coercive institution of the state, what is the ideal level of size of that collective? Should it be city and community, or county or state, or something the size of the United States? Should it be something the size of Canada, or should it be global? And
I
why?
I think there's an argument that we would want, you know, something a little bit more global, but I think the federal government is an important institution in this country. I mean, largely not so much theoretically, but largely because of just what we've seen in this country. I think the existence of a federal government is why we have as poorly as we've executed, at least the aspiration for integrated schools, for some measure of equality. I think it is, we can see it in the context of providing things like health care and Social Security insurance. I mean, is there an argument to break up America into three separate countries? I don't know, maybe, but the GI Bill, the VA, I mean, I think the idea that you could move from state to state and know that there is at the very least some measure of consistency because you, available to you through the VA. I mean, I think the VA is a great example of an institution that could not exist except for on that scale.
Okay. There's so much in there to respond to. And you point out a lot of the good things that the federal government has achieved. But if especially in terms of social progress there and respect for rights. But then you look at the issue of slavery, just go back and say, well, you know, we're the only country. This is the only country in the world that needed a war to abolish slavery and didn't even do a very good job of it. So in that sense, it hasn't been a great track record of accomplishing these things. And I'm not saying it's not important. I'm not saying it hasn't done great things. Generally speaking, I look at those examples. I think that's more the government taking credit of things for things that the people deserve a lot more credit for. But I'm saying that things can be better just because we've used violence to get to this point. You know, for example, I'm a vegan, and a lot of people making the case for eating meat will say, well, you know, humanity, if we didn't kill animals when we were hunters and gatherers, we would never have had the brain explosion and evolved to where we are today. And I go, yeah, sure. That's true. That I'm not arguing history here. I'm just saying, look at where we are now. Look at these ethical principles. Look at how we can apply them to make the world a better place. And you go, yeah, there's some really compelling reasons that we need to examine the fundamental premises of government.
Now, on some level, was not the South using that right that you talked about of secession? And I guess, I mean, so the federal government had two choices there, right? It's either you can secede and the slavery would exist in those southern states, whatever that country would be called, the Confederacy, and in the Union of the United States of America, we wouldn't have slavery. I mean,
eventually the Confederacy or the Confederate states would have ended slavery as well as a practice, and for the people in the North
you think there would have been a gentle unwinding of that?
Certainly more gentle than a war, yeah, and it wouldn't have been gentle. I mean, slavery was a brutal institution that needed
to be
ended.
How do you imagine that would have ended? Let's say they just did secede, and it was a separate country.
How did it end in every other country in the world? In the United States, it would have been very easy to allow runaway slaves to come to the northern states. It would have been relatively easy to purchase them, to encourage that, to change the economic incentives for the southern institutions that depended on slavery. The invention of the cotton gin obviously drastically reduced the need for human labor. There were lots of ways that slavery was abolished in other countries that would have worked just fine in the United States.
How many years would you imagine it would have taken for slavery to end? And then how many more years? I mean, the rollout of technology, a concerted effort for people to buy freed slaves from the North. Then we start getting into the late 1800s. Presumably, the South is going to be a little bit upset that across the border, their former, you know, that this country is now starting to welcome in dissidents, I guess, right?
Sure.
I mean, so no, now we start getting into the early 1900s. I'm just saying that, like, the assumption that everything would have taken care of itself and everything would have been
that's not
what's that?
It's not that it would have taken care of itself. It would have required a significant social effort, as it did. That social effort would have been much better manifest along ethical grounds than along the grounds of starting a war.
Hey, I can't hear what you're saying, Michael. All right. So eventually slavery would have ended by itself, right? Is that the point?
Sorry, say again, please.
Eventually, if we had allowed the South to secede, it would have resolved itself. And presumably these generations of people who had spent another decade or two, maybe some quasi years of I think the situation for literally millions of former slaves and then ongoing slaves would have been worth. Michael wants me to mention Haiti, but I mean, I think like there's plenty of, I think, just sort of rational assessment of that may have been problematic. I'm not promoting the idea of war, but sure. The South, I don't think, was in a huge hurry to give up slavery. Now, maybe they eventually would have. I presume by now, I would like to think that they would have. But I just don't see the evidence that necessarily you're going to get something better with a smaller form of government. I mean, surely you've lived in small towns. You know, I've lived in very small towns. The level of corruption there is as big as anywhere. In some respects, it's even deeper. People who grab that power there do so as a way because they can genuinely influence their own personal outcomes. But let's go back to the notion of.
Hold on. If I may, you raised like two separate points I'd like to respond to there. First, my reading of the history of the Civil War, and I don't pretend to be any historical expert, but seems to include a lot of negative consequences in the Jim Crow South and all of the lynchings and negative consequences that followed the Civil War for a lot of people, as is true about the aftermath of every war, especially in the case of the Civil War with the amputees. But if you look at the bigger dynamics, there were a lot of other problems. My reading of the history, again, not as an expert, makes it clear to me that a nonviolent solution would have been better for everyone in the long run to the Civil War, looking at the problem of slavery. In the question of small towns,
I can tell you that Lincoln did try to buy the slaves. You know that, right? You know that Lincoln did offer that to buy the slaves, essentially. I mean,
I'm sorry. That part of the story.
Oh, well, all right. Well, like you say, you didn't. You should look into the attempts by Lincoln to actually to do that in terms of economically. And I guess you could argue that the North should have just let the South secede. Maybe there would have been a slave. I'm sorry.
But Lincoln actually offered to buy every individual slave in the South in order to prevent the war from happening.
Well, I don't think he did it by individual. I think the idea was here's a lot of cash.
Sorry, does he think that slavery was not violence?
Well, no, he said slavery was violence. He said slavery was violence. But yeah, no, cool. you should look into that. There was exactly attempts to buy the federal government. To essentially, here's lump sums. I mean, I don't know if he was going to go around and go each individual slave, but I think the idea was here are massive payments so that you will give up slavery. And that was...
I did research on that.
Yes. No, you should. So, but
small towns versus big towns, you're absolutely right to point out that small governments still have corruption. Small local governments don't have an NSA or a CIA or an FBI or a drug war or start wars.
Well,
and lose trillions.
They do have a drug war. They do have a drug war. They don't have an NSA or a CIA. They would end up building their own.
Part of the reason,
New York City, right, had its own little CIA. You know that. They literally had, they were sending people as far afield as New England to go and spy on Muslims. Cities can do it. And yeah. In the absence of a federal government, I can assure you they will. The yeah, reason why they don't have those now is because the federal government has that. And the federal government says, you can't compete with us on this. Allowed New York City to do that, but you're going to get that. I mean, they're going to know everybody's name. That's the only difference. You look at Ferguson, right?
Thanks for bringing out more of the evils of government for me, Sam.
Well, listen, I'm not arguing that there's no bad parts of government. I'm not arguing that there aren't parts of government that I would like to curtail or diminish.
What if I told you there was a way to keep all the good parts and get rid of all the bad parts?
I would say you haven't told me yet. I'm open to that. What is it?
Okay, well, it's that people are still able to come together in voluntary ways to form the collectives to do all the good things that you want government to do. If you want a government welfare system, fine. You just can't steal from people in order to get it. People can still pool their resources and get that. You want a community where...
Wait, what do you mean by steal? Let me just get clear. You consider taxation...
You can have that as long as you don't force it on anybody.
So, all right. Give me an example of a country with 100 million people where you do that. And by steal, you mean tax, right?
Right. Because taxation is theft.
Right. Where do we see an example of what you're talking about? A totally voluntary, voluntaristic, country. And maybe you can't do it on that scale. That does not have a central authority, and that everything they do is done with the consent of everyone else in that community. I've never even heard of like communes where there aren't rules.
Sure. Well, you know, there was a point in human history where slavery was the norm. And if you said, hey, without slavery, who's going to pick the cotton? We've never had a society that exists without slavery. You know, that's not an argument for keeping slavery going. Similarly, when you see that the current status quo of the world, of statism, of turning to coercive monopolies to address social problems is wrong, you do what you can to move past it based on principle.
But Adam, I'm not saying that because it hasn't existed, that that's proof that it cannot exist. I'm saying that's a piece of evidence. But I mean, I could, you know, saying that because there was a time where slavery was a norm and we ultimately got rid of it is not that those are not analogous. I'm not saying, hey, there was a time where humans couldn't fly, so maybe someday we'll be able to fly. I mean, that's not the argument I'm making. I'm simply making like you're trying to premise to offer the notion that we can have a society of 300 million people, or let's say, I don't know, you want to say New York City, just a million people.
Seven million
people where...
Billion with a B.
7 billion people where everybody just agrees to all the rules and there's no material conflicts about how society is going to operate and there is no central, there's no one who has, no one entity that has a monopoly of authority to adjudicate these differences. That to me seems fantastical. And
you're misrepresenting something. You're misrepresenting something very important. Because when you say all rules, you're still in this current paradigm of thinking of uniformity, of a sort of flat texture of society. When in a free world, there are differences among different groups of people in different communities. So we don't have to agree on all the rules globally. We only have to agree on one rule, and that's you own yourself and I own myself. And on ethical grounds,
what about property rights? What about property rights?
Right. Well, I generally believe in the Lockean concept of property rights. This seems to be the same one that's in line with this ethical concept of self-ownership. Of course, it's subjective, based on how much labor mixing with natural resources qualifies you to own something.
Yeah, what if I don't?
There's a certain amount of subjectivity in that.
What if I don't?
What if you don't?
Yeah, what if I come from, let's say, a tradition of, let's say, Native American tradition of that does not recognize the property rights in a Lockean fashion? How do we resolve that? Well, you have a house. I walk into the house. I look around. I'm like, I'm going to sleep here tonight. How do we resolve that?
Well, I think generally speaking, we respect the right of ownership of a domicile, of a home, of a place to be able to protect yourself from the elements. But no, it comes down to being able to defend
that. I don't accept that. What do we do about it? I'm
going to defend my home against intruders.
Wait, what? You're not going to get a grit? You're going to initiate force against me?
Well, when I believe that I'm defending my property and I'm asserting that I have a right to own that and you have violated my property, then that would be the act of aggression.
I assert that you don't have a right to own that property.
Well, I would hope that we could find a nonviolent way of resolving that.
You just told me I wasn't doing anything violent to you, man. I just came into your house. I was going to sleep. And you just told me you were going to beat me up.
Well, I'm gonna ask you to leave. I'm gonna defend my home by force if necessary.
Your home?
I'm not defending that here.
Wait, what do you mean your home? I don't even get that. Where I come from, my people, we don't have your home. It's everybody's home. I'm gonna sleep here tonight because I need to sleep,
universal reality of the human condition of being an independent consciousness in your own body that comes with it a certain concept of ownership that you own yourself.
I know you own you, but this is a house. It's not a you. It's not alive. It's land. It's part of.
Well, let me ask you: if I walk up to you and I say you don't own that shirt, and I start ripping that shirt off you, what are you going to do?
I'm going to call the police.
Okay, so you have an agreement with someone else to do exactly what I would be doing for myself for you. That's fine.
But wait a second. I don't have a non-aggression principle. Wait a second. I acknowledge that you could come up and grab my shirt, and that's why I subscribe to the idea that we as a society need to provide a monopoly of authority to the state. And that comes with a lot of conditions in my mind.
Right.
And there may be disagreements about how that relationship works. But fundamentally, I understand that because you and I may have a different concept of who owns this shirt, that I need to subscribe to an authority that will adjudicate it. And you don't. You don't think that we need a third party to adjudicate it, but at the same time, you're also telling me that, see, from my perspective, you're arbitrarily drawing a line, and that is property rights exist. Now, it's one thing to say, like, okay, as a human being, freedom, okay, that doesn't implicate anybody else, but it's the moment you draw a line around something and say, this is mine too, not just this human body that I take with me, but this other stuff is mine. Well, then you're implicating the rest of us because it's not an infinite resource, and it's not one that is portable with yourself. You're deciding property rights are okay, and that doesn't make any sense. Based on what? That taking property is in and of itself a violent, aggressive act because you are saying that I deem this area to be off limits to you.
So this is based on the idea that as an individual human being, we all own ourselves.
Right.
And as human beings on this planet, we have a right to equitable access to natural resources. Now, it sounds like you're scared almost of giving up all of the securities and protections provided by the current system and the status quo. And that makes sense. A lot of people feel that. But if you step back and you look at all of the problems facing humanity today, you look at the violence that's done in the world today, and you look at the violence that's been done over the course of human history, how humans have died by each other's hands. It's very conservative to estimate that even today, 90%+ of the violence and coercion in the world is done in the name of governments. And it's really heartless to say, well, because I can't figure out this situation or this abstract situation or this scenario or this concept of property rights. And Sam, you are absolutely right to point out that without a government, people coming together peacefully will have to come up with better mechanisms to solve these conflicts. It's not going to be automatic. It's not just poof, government's gone and everything's, you know, better. No, absolutely not. I'm not suggesting that. What I am suggesting is that when we identify the unethical grounds, the unethical premises of an institution, we have a moral imperative to try to see how we move past those. And I understand
but we haven't. See, you and I have not agreed on that ethical problem. I mean, okay. you one breath say that we have universal access to resources, yet you want to draw a line around stuff and say, this is my property. Now, I don't have a problem with property rights, but that's not, I don't have any massive principle that says that I cannot, I have a problem with anything that is aggressive or in any way invades. I understand that property rights are an offense to other people on some level. I am excluding people from access to those resources. Well, and that's just part of the way that society, we have found society to function. I would like to loosen and diminish some of those property rights so people can't own so much so that they get a little bit closer to the size of their body, okay? As opposed to owning huge tracts of land or maybe even like mansions.
Like the system that you're doing, the system that you're defending here is doing exactly what you're saying is a problem here. So let me give you an example from my experience.
I definitely think that we can reform our system so that property rights are not as preeminent as you would make them in an era where there's nobody to even adjudicate them.
Okay, so I own 10 acres in the mountains in Arizona, and I'm building a homestead on 10 acres. And I could have gotten 40 acres. I could have gotten 160 acres. I could have gotten more. But there's a reason I got 10 acres, is that I believe that 10 acres is what I'm going to use, and that I can reasonably say, even without government giving me a deed and saying that I own this little square, if I put up a fence around 10 acres and I claim that I'm using 10 acres and I'm building a homestead and I want to support a family and I want to be able to make a home and raise plant, you know, farm and do whatever, you know, I want to do to be self-sustaining there, that it's going to be a long time before the population of the planet gets so big that someone's going to say 10 acres is too much for you. So I think that there's not just a respect under the current paradigm. I think under my principled paradigm of the future, there's still a fundamental respect for that. Now, if I put up a fence around 1 million acres in Wyoming, right? Let's say I go out to the plains in Wyoming and I put up a fence around 1 million acres and I say, screw you guys, I own 1 million acres, this is all mine. If I'm not using it, that's not a legitimate property rights claim. So in order for me to claim 1 million acres, I would not only have to have a legitimate claim based on usage, I would have to have the consent of society around me that no one else is going to claim that and homestead it. If I put up a fence around 1 million acres and I live in a house in the corner, I can't stop someone from coming and claiming 10 acres in the far corner.
But wait a second. Here's what I don't understand. Who decides that you're using that 1 million acres properly, and who decides that you're using that 10 acres properly?
Well, so under our current system, it's government. Under what I'm suggesting, it would be done by social consent.
Okay. How many people would it take to breach that social consent?
Oh, it's going to depend on the circumstance. Again, you're asking a question.
But I'm asking the question that, like, okay, we do have some migration of people, or maybe somebody comes up to your 10 acres and sees like, hey, man, he's not using that. That, what is that? A tree house? That's not, I don't consider that use. I consider only food. In fact, the only legitimate use I think is legitimate is digging for oil. And I'm going to come in there with my drilling machine, and I'm going to drill for oil on your property. That's use, right? Because that oil is going to power vehicles all around the country. You're just making lettuce for yourself.
Sure.
Who adjudicates that in your world?
Well, one of the things that...
Just sheer force? Do I win because I got an oil company and I got more guns than you do? I mean, who adjudicates that?
Well, I already told you that it was based on the concept of social consent, right? So one of the things
I don't know what that means.
Standard...
I understand. I honestly don't understand what you're talking about. What does social consent mean in this context? Well, like, what is the app? How does that? What does that look like in the real world?
Are you going to let me explain?
Yeah.
Okay. So in your scenario, when you say that you come in to my property with an oil company and you're going to drill there, there's a certain amount of social consent behind you doing that, because an oil company is not something that one individual can create by themselves. There has to be an organization and an institution and a huge customer base in order to do that. A big part of what I am advocating is an increase in awareness that results in a higher level of conscientious consumerism. So today, in terms of settling disputes and all of these services provided by government, we're not very conscientious consumers. We let the government take whatever it takes out of our paychecks. We go and vote every 2 years, and we generally let it do its thing without questioning it or looking for alternatives or competition. So in the case of the consent with this oil company, if it was under the government would be protecting that oil company's right to exist as a corporation. In the society that I envision, there would be a level of conscientiousness required for that oil company to come together and violate my property that in such a way that I would be able to appeal to the people behind that and challenge that consent and say, hey, guys, I actually own this property. Is this really what you want to do? There's a way that we can address this peacefully as opposed to having the government force corporate rights onto my property.
Okay. Now, you understand that you say the government allows the corporation to come there. The government also, in my world, regulates the company from going on there. But let's say like Chevron going down Wait a second. I've heard your scenario, and I don't know how you appeal to the customers of Chevron who don't know who you are. I don't know how you appeal to them. I don't know if you do it through YouTube or what, to say, hey, your company that you buy gasoline from, they're coming and digging on my property, because it didn't work that well for Latin America, I can assure you.
It wouldn't be possible at that point. Like, I mean, what you're saying is like, what if we figure out indoor plumbing and then someone doesn't shower for a year? Aren't they going to smell? Yeah, but that's not a reason to not have indoor plumbing.
I've given you a scenario. I'm not following that. I've given you a scenario where an oil company comes to your property. You say you can't come onto this property because I use all the 10 acres. That's how I determine that I get to own this property, because I use it all. And the oil company says you use it all according to the Adam Kokesh definition of use. But according to the Chevron definition of use, this is all unused property because there's oil underneath you. So we're going to dig there.
Right.
And you're telling me that in the scenario you are envisioning, you will be able to go to appeal to the customers of Chevron and to the people who work there and the board of directors or whatever it is, the group, whatever committee they have, and say, hey, I'm growing lettuce here. Don't go and dig for oil. And that's
right.
That's
right. Right. Yeah.
Do I have that right?
Not exactly. No, not exactly. So you're presuming that people are dicks. I mean, you're going from like
I'm presuming that oil companies are dicks. Yes.
Exactly. So, but oil people who are in charge of oil companies and people who are in charge of governments are dicks by and large.
Wait. Let's stick with oil companies because oil companies are going to, I can assure you, like after spending, I spend a lot of time going and talking to tort lawyers who go and they, through discovery, see the documents from corporations when they are breaking the rules of government. They're doing it in secret because they don't want to get caught. And I got news for you. In these corporations, there are some real dicks. And some of them are in oil companies. Some of them are in pharmaceuticals. Some of them are in manufacturing. There are dicks in the world. And they don't care about you or your lettuce that you're growing on your property. They want the oil or they want the profit.
All right. So, I can tell you're getting really excited about this, and there's a lot that you're passionate about here, and you see a lot of injustice in the world that really motivates you. And I appreciate that, and I really respect that because, you know, me as an activist, you know, I started with Iraq Veterans Against the War. I think in that sense, I really respect that we both come from an activist
mentality. It's mutual.
We're motivated by a deep-seated sense of injustice.
Yes.
So you keep kind of running over me trying to explain stuff, going back to all of these problems with the current status quo and with the injustices of today. So I'm going to try to make this really short on the points that you bring up with corporatism and property rights and all of that, is that by and large, people are good people. Like, you know, I don't want to play this game. Are people good or evil? No, but by and large, people are nice, cooperative. They want to get along. They don't want to, you know, drill and spill oil and fracking water all over my lettuce. You know, like generally people don't want to do that. So there's a system today where the people who want to be assholes have this system of government corporatism that protects them from real accountability. I want to take that protection away from them. I want the general body of the people of the world who are good people to stop allowing corporations as special legal entities and governments with special violent privileges to exist. Let's stop empowering them. Let's have a higher standard of behavior. Let's have a better mechanism of accountability. That's what I'm suggesting. I think that we can address. I'm not saying that the problems that you're raising are not legitimate. I'm not saying that I have the perfect answer to every single one of them. I'm just pointing out there's a underlying element of a false ethical premise underneath the current system of governments, and we can do better if we examine that and really seek a more ethical society.
I'm not making an ethical argument. I'm making a practical one, because what you are suggesting to me sounds like feudalism. And what you see these corporations as being enabled by the government, and I see them as being in a flawed manner, without a doubt, and I would like to strengthen this. I mean, my proactive agenda would be far less freedom for these groups of people who organize to dig oil, let's say, in particular, among others. And what you're suggesting to me is feudalism, because I haven't heard of an example of a mechanism. Like what you're suggesting to me is utopian. I think maybe, even if I agree that most people are basically good, which I think I do, the fact is there are bad actors, and there are bad actors who accumulate in a system of property more power and property than other people. And it's not often a coincidence that bad actors do this, because they are willing to do things to accumulate more, which necessarily come out of the hide of other people. And so I'm saying that humanity has this problem. And what's the most efficient way that we have found in dealing with it? And in my mind, it is government. And government, at least, is a vehicle in which we can attempt to improve and exist beyond the lifespan of humans, so that we don't have to recreate this and hope that that each successive generation, or every time someone moves from one state to another or migrates over, that there's a certain set of rules that we can rely on. And I would also say that I think government does a lot of great things for people. Social insurance, keeping people out of poverty. It would be nice, I think, in a world where everyone just figured out a way and everybody could agree on the best, most practical methodology to fulfill those human needs that you talked about. But unless I hear of, like, you know, even an example of how we resolve the conflict, the simple conflict of your property and some entity that wants to come and use it or take it. I mean, we couldn't even resolve what happens when I walk into your house and want to take a nap there. And so there's,
if you really want to get into those hypotheticals, I'm happy to, but
we have been
the statement that you made at the very beginning there of what you just said, I think is most important in illuminating the difference in our worldviews. And this could really be the crux and the difference between libertarianism and all forms of statism. And it's that you're saying the ends justify the means. You're willing to look at what's practical over what's ethical. And I reject that. I say, no, principle is pragmatic. There's no dichotomy here of principle versus pragmatism. When you do unprincipled things, you get impractical results. Government, you look at the cost-benefit analysis, really clearly bears that out if you want the examples. But no, I am not willing to do something or support something or advocate for something that is unethical because I see some practical benefit.
Well, I mean, you and I disagree on what constitutes unethical. I don't think taxes are unethical at all. And so we have a fundamental disagreement there. But I would also add that for me, you're right. I do not have a I do not have the confidence that I have the access to a fundamental truth that beyond wanting to meet as much human need and mitigate as much human suffering as possible. And after that basic agenda, it's what is the most pragmatic way to do that? So I don't have the dilemma that you have. I don't think taxes are unethical. I don't think that it is fundamentally wrong to join a social compact, even if I didn't get the opportunity to opt out. I mean, I could leave the United States, but everything that's here is a function of other people having been in the social compact before I was born. And there is really no place to go on the planet where, for the most part, I mean, maybe there's some reaches of the planet where you can go, where you're not walking on the suffering or the achievements of others. And so I don't have those same ethical problems. So I'm not making that calculation that you assume I'm making, that the ends justifies the means. I don't think the means are so horrific. So I don't have that dilemma.
So when you're going about the system, I assume that you have some concept of ethics. You have some limitation for what government can or cannot do or should or shouldn't do. What is the foundation of your system of ethics? And how would you describe your concept of ethics?
Well, I mean, I have a system of personal ethics. But in terms of what government can and cannot do, I mean, I think
there's no such thing as, like, when I mean ethics here, at least what I'm asking here is not like personal something. What universal human ethics is in code of conduct behavior between human beings?
Well, I think we should operate in a way that maximizes or that minimizes human suffering and that maximizes the satisfaction of human need.
So that's those aren't really ethical principles. Those are objectives. Looking like ethical principles, like what's right and what's wrong. How do you determine what what you're describing there describes an approach or an attitude or an objective. How I'm asking for, what is your line between right and wrong?
Well, I have a set of personal ethics, but things that bring about, that mitigate human suffering. And
so you don't have a universal concept of ethics. You can't tell me a system where every human being should get along by universal rules that apply to everybody. You don't have that.
Well, I mean, I think that we have a flawed system of making that determination in the context of our society.
Well, so I'm suggesting that, you know, when you look at what is ethics, it's not that hard to come to a consistent conclusion. Say, you know, as an individual consciousness in its own body,
I guess it is hard for me to do that because I don't see the point. I mean,
You don't see the point of determining what's right and wrong.
Well, I don't have. I mean, I've told you, and you don't accept it. I have a test, and that test is not the test does not exist in a vacuum. It exists based upon what I see. I don't have my concept of good and evil or right or wrong does not exist in a vacuum. It exists in the world.
But it's purely based on practical outcome, then you don't have a principle. You have a way of measuring outcomes and judging outcomes.
I'm telling you, it is based on the principle as to what provides the best outcomes.
Okay, well, I would say that when you examine that closely enough, you get past that superficial level of what looks practical. You start getting to principles. The one principle is nonviolence. Nonviolent cooperation is better than...
I think nonviolent cooperation is better than violent non-cooperation? Yes. But it, you know, I mean, Adam, with respect, you and I differ in the sense that you are a fundamentalist. You have some.
All right.
Well, it's true.
I believe in fundamentals. I believe in ethics. I'm a fundamentalist.
No, okay. You're a fundamentalist. I mean, definitely. This is not a pejorative. This is a value neutral term. But you operate under a set of values that do not that the real world examples are irrelevant at the end of the day. Outcomes, like you say, are not going to in any way impact your set of fundamental beliefs, and that I don't operate that way. I look at the world and I see changing dynamics.
If you're going to characterize me that way, let me just at least I do believe in putting principles first, but I test those principles against pragmatic results.
Well, but we've had examples here. I mean, like I keep giving you the opportunity to test those principles in the context of like real world scenarios, which is, hey, my tribe lives here. Chevron's coming and taking our land and expropriating it for their own for their own desire to profit. I mean, we have so many examples of this.
And that's a real
you
problem.
Can't
and
give
every
case, me
government
a, can make worse. You can't give me a mechanism in which that doesn't happen except to say that you're going to appeal to the consumers of Chevron. And that doesn't work.
Right. Because right now what we have, so I'm not, again, you're saying that Adam, if what you're advocating isn't perfect, then we're
going
to stick
with what we have.
No, I'm not
saying not perfect. I'm saying completely dysfunctional.
No.
I'm not saying it's flawed. I'm saying it doesn't exist.
Okay, again, I agree with you that it doesn't exist. So you're not like making a counterpoint there. You're just repeating yourself because I'm telling you, like, this is something that we are progressing towards as a species. We are getting less violent over time. And this isn't my observations. This is Professor Steven Pinker at Harvard who has proven academically that violence is on a decay curve over the course of human existence. We are getting less violent over time. That's progress. I want to see that progress continued. And in these scenarios that you throw at me, there's not a single one where you go, you know, violence made this situation better on some kind of principled grounds. No, when Chevron comes in to some Native American land, it's always with the protection of government. You want to look at how it's always been. You go, yeah, we've always had a government making that worse, empowering those corporations, protecting them from accountability to their consumers, limiting choice, limiting competition.
I mean, I guess we're not going to resolve this, but I think, you know, I I guess, you know, I don't know if you would agree that your prescription is utopian in some way. I mean, to me, it sort of feels that way. The biggest problem.
Oh, no. The opposite. The prescription of statism, of saying that we can have a violent central authority and that's going to solve our problems, that's utopian.
Okay.
But Sam, let me step back for a second and say, you said we're not going to like resolve this. I don't think the point of this conversation is to resolve. So I just want to say I'm having a lot of fun. And I think this conversation has been really good in illuminating the differences. And I think this has been a really good exchange. And I'm really grateful for how you've engaged in this. And again, for the opportunity to present that you've given me in the course of this conversation to present my ideas to your audience.
Well, Adam, I appreciate your coming on and also, creating the innovative new technology that we're using, where we the first Skype call. But yeah, I appreciate your coming on, Adam, and thanks for sharing
The favor. Hopefully, I get to return the favor soon. I mean, I'm working on bringing back Adam versus the Man in a variety of forms, and it would be an honor to keep this conversation going.
I'm there. I'll do it. I appreciate it, Adam Kokesh. Where should people go again?
Let me get my plugs in.
Yes.
This is my book. I don't have a copy of it here because all my copies where I'm at right now are in envelopes, in press kits, going out to announce the Big Easy Book Bomb. This is my libertarian manifesto. It's 100 pages. It's free in every digital format possible, including audiobook. I don't know if you can see that there.
Freedomline.com?
TheFreedomLine.com. We are about to deliver over 200,000 copies of this book, one to every single residential mailbox in the city of New Orleans. And I will be there the first 2 weeks of January. Very much looking forward to that. My website, thefreedomline.com. You can email me, adam@thefreedomline.com. Sam, thank you. And thanks to everybody who's made this possible.
Adam, thank you. I have to ask, how are you getting it to the mailboxes?
USPS, baby, government mail.
All right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
The books are printed in communist China.
Beautiful. All right. Thanks. All right. Thanks, Adam. Bye-bye. That is not necessarily the least violent way to print your books, it seems to me, but...
Can I just say something that maybe will be in slightly poor taste, but I'm going to do it in character?
Hold on for 1 second. Okay. All right, wait. Let's go into the fun half.
Oh my God.
We're going to do a short, obviously fun half today, but that was fun. There was a little murmuring around here that I didn't appreciate. You can't talk off camera like that. It's distracting.
Oh, sorry.
It's like the old days.
It's like the old days.
I mean, most of it was like, let me at him. I got some stuff to say. I feel like I could do very well against a right-wing libertarian in a debate.
I think that would be a great programmatic choice for the Antifada, but that's when I get a libertarian. Forget it.
I know.
It's like sending me to an all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet. I'm not going to...
Sam claims property rights.
Exactly. Yeah,
quiet it down and let you... Consciousness was definitely not evolving during
I did not. I felt like my consciousness was actually narrowing.
But we quieted down.
I know. All right. Folks, just remember, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. The tickets for the January 13th Live Majority Report are selling like it's almost like the crumbs of hotcakes now. There's so few left. So you better hurry. Head over to majority.fm. You also just have a couple of days left, I think, to go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. 30% off. No coupon code needed for the next couple of days. 30% off. Last night was Tuesday. Michael miraculously got healthy again.
Miraculously. It was nice. Got some rest in. I needed to rest up in preparation for listening to you debate a libertarian.
There you go. Exactly.
Matt Taibbi was in studio. We did it. What is it? It wasn't that bad.
Oh, yeah. What?
It was one reference.
No.
It would have helped you. Go ahead. Well, actually, watch how a pro handles this. So we talked to Matt Taibbi, and like, stop me! I can't do it. I can't. I'm trying to talk about a property hypothetical.
Go ahead.
Oh my God! I'm so upset. This is gonna go another 45 minutes.
I was trying to keep it. I couldn't.
He pulled the plug on it.
Yeah, that was amazing. I've never seen a libertarian.
Well, Daryl Perry jetpacked out.
Well, Daryl Perry had a real jetpack.
I just got to say that I used to answer the door with Seventh-day Adventists. I had at least on two occasions them going, "We got to go."
Oh, I'm sure you tortured those poor ladies.
I was just like, wait.
I was just so excited by the direction you were going in. I wanted you to fit something in. Matt Taibbi was in. We talked about Facebook, the future of journalism, why the Assange case matters, regardless of what you think of Assange, if he is indeed charged. Big deep dive on Macron, a letter from Lula. This Sunday, Liz Brunig with an illicit history of Beto O'Rourke. For patrons, patreon.com/TMBO. Indeed,
have you already recorded that?
Yeah, sorry.
Have you already recorded?
No, recording it tomorrow morning.
Oh, jeez.
It's phase two of the coordinated campaign.
Phase two of the coordinated campaign. It's actually we're going to do an illicit primer on all of the presidential contenders for patrons. Patreon.com/TMBS. Halfway sold out for the Bell House show. Get your tickets at the homepage as well. Hopefully, see you at both shows.
Jamie.
Out now on the Antifada. This episode just dropped today, in which we speak with Justin Akers Chacon, author of Radicals in the Barrio, Magonistas, Socialists, Wobblies, and Communists in the Mexican-American Working Class. We talk with him about how immigrants from Mexico and other places have actually breathed life into the U.S. labor movement through history, and how the criminalization of migration only ever hurts the working class and benefits the capitalist class. Check it out.
And Matt?
Yep, Literary Hangover, still on the Democracy in Chains episode we released this last weekend.
All right, folks, good. Quick break. Fun half. See you in a minute.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.